You are listening to the Indefensive Plants podcast, a show designed to cure plant blindness around the globe. Support for Indefensive Plants comes from listener donations. If you would like to give your support to Indefensive Plants, please consider becoming a patron over at patreon.com/indefensiveplants. And together, we can help cure plant blindness one episode at a time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Indefensive Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefensiveplants.com. What's up? This is your host, Matt. Welcome to the show. How's everyone doing this week? Today, we are diving underwater to talk about aquatic plants in the context of aquascaping. Joining us is competitive aquascaper Marvin Lowe, and I knew Marvin and I were going to get along from the moment we met. Marvin is an avid aquarist who has become very passionate for the realm of aquatic gardening. Now, if you've ever seen me give a talk, you'll know that one of my initial introductions to the world of growing plants actually happened through the world of aquariums. I was an avid fish keeper, and once I realized that you can make your fish tanks look more naturalistic with plants, I was kind of hooked. Not to say that I was obsessed with plants at that point, but it definitely changed my mind about the role plants play in the environment. And you never know where lessons like that are going to come from, which is why I'm so excited to talk with Marvin today. As you're going to hear, it's a whole new world that's growing in popularity, and it offers the average homeowner a whole new realm of, technically, houseplants, just ones that live underwater. But speaking of houseplants, let's hear a quick word from today's sponsor.
Hey, this is Summer Rain Oaks from Homestead Brooklyn, one of the proud sponsors of the In Defense of Plants podcast. I wanted to let listeners know that we just released the Houseplant Masterclass, which is the first comprehensive online audiovisual course on houseplant cultivation, care, and maintenance. The first 100 people who register using the code PIONEERPLANT will get $25 off the course and a houseplant discount bundle worth $45 from some of our favorite plant purveyors. Check it out at houseplantmasterclass.com.
Thanks, Summer. Make sure you go check that out. I will put up links in the show notes for this episode. If you're one of those people who likes to say they have a black thumb, this is probably a good chance to change that. All right, that's enough rambling out of me. Let's head on over to my conversation with Marvin. I hope you enjoy. All right, Marvin Lowe, welcome to the podcast. How about you tell everyone a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Hi, my name's Marvin, and it's nice to meet everyone. So what I do is I'm an aquascaper, and most people, you know, they ask me, like, what is aquascaping? What do you do exactly? Like, I've never heard that term. I like to refer to it as landscaping in an aquarium. So I'm starting to become a professional aquascaper at this point, so I'm really competitive, and there's a lot of kind of competitive aspects to this art, I would call it. So, you know, I started out mainly growing just aquariums, like just keeping aquariums with fish in them. And then at some point, I discovered that there was actually plants that would grow underwater. And because of that, I started looking more and more into this aquatic plant hobby. You know, most people think plants you keep outside in a pond, you know, and you can't really do them inside. But there was a small group of people who were keeping plants in aquariums indoors. And a lot of them happened to originate over in Asia. So a lot of Asian people tended to do that more than, say, the Europeans or the Americans. So in 2007, I think, is when I saw my first aquascaped aquarium, and I just like fell in love with it because it was just so different than anything I'd ever seen at any pet store in the US. So after that, I got bit by the aquarium plant bug, and I was just searching the internet for all sorts of stuff where I could find out more information about growing aquarium plants underwater. And that's kind of where, how it all started.
That's awesome. And I'm so excited that you're on here. Finally, we get to talk about this because some people listening might know that really aquarium plants were my first introduction to anything resembling trying to grow plants. It wasn't very successful, and I certainly didn't get bit by the botany bug then. But when you say aquascaping, I get really excited because that is such a big part of what kind of made me into the nature nut that I am today. And I really understand why you get really into it. And there's a lot we can talk about from species to design and stuff like that. But it would be interesting to know how your first attempts at growing aquarium plants really panned out. Because, you know, like you said, people think about ponds and aquatic plants as being kind of these things stuck in the mud outside.
growing them in an aquarium is an entirely different process, but it's almost more rewarding just because of the vantage point you get.
Oh, yeah. So my first attempts were extremely poor. There wasn't a wealth of information. It's a fairly new hobby. It probably started about like in the 1980s, 1970s. There was definitely an aquarium plant aspect to it, but it was treated in a manner that wasn't so technologically advanced. So a lot of what I read was basically what we refer to as like low tech or like low energy tanks, where we all know that plants need CO2 to survive. And it's kind of, you know, it's not intuitive to assume that there's a lot of CO2 in the water. So most of all these low tech tanks relied on these like yeast generators, where people would put yeast and sugar water together. And then, you know, the bubbles would come out and you'd kind of plumb it into the aquarium and try and distribute it into the water and get it to dissolve. So that's kind of how I started out. I remember having this like little bubble ladder. So a CO2 bubble would exit this tubing in the tank, and then it would kind of like travel up the ladder slowly and like kind of slowly dissolve into the water. And it was just extremely difficult to get plants to grow because of that fact. And the lighting that existed in the industry was not geared towards growing plants. So it's mostly like fluorescent lighting or incandescent lighting, and that wasn't nearly strong enough for a lot of these plants that grow in nature in full sunlight sometimes. So it was a difficult start, I would say, but I persevered and I kind of like kept trying to grow plants, and eventually the needs were kind of being met by the technology. So at some point it transitioned over to higher tech tanks, what we call higher energy tanks.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point to be made, is just, again, how recent some of the successes and really kind of the whole hobby being where it is today. It's relatively recent and new, and a lot of that is that tech limitation. So in thinking about trying to grow an aquatic plant, it's definitely not as easy as going to your local garden center, grabbing a pot, grabbing some soil, and throwing it in there and putting it on a windowsill. You know, what kind of considerations do you have to deal with when it comes to aquatic plants that you wouldn't have to deal with, say, normal house plants?
So dealing with aquatic plants is slightly more difficult because they're kind of always in, the biggest issue is they're always in the environment in which they have access to nutrients. And there's a lot of competition from other things in the aquarium, such as algae or bacteria, and all these other organisms are also competing with your plants. But we want our plants to grow as well as possible. The problem is a lot of these algae, they tend to thrive better in situations in where like a nutrient is limited, or there might be too much light or not enough CO2. So the algae, most beginners, I feel, they always have an issue with some kind of nutrient limitation or too much light or too much CO2. So they're always, it's a balance issue in aquarium, and that's extremely important to keep in mind when you're working in the aquarium. So understanding how these nutrients and this light and the CO2 is all balanced out is one very important aspect that I think people tend not to understand as much when they first start out. And then they slowly, as they gain experience, they kind of realize how to do that and handle it as time goes on.
Yeah, and one of the things that I really appreciated early on was kind of always being this biology nerd in some form or another. I always liked studying life, no matter what. And the quick thing I realized was that you almost had to go through a crash course in basic biology, or at least basic botany, to really understand what you were needing to go to the store for your aquatic plants. It really did kind of help you understand, even though aquatic plants are kind of strange in the context of all plant life in terms of how they make a living, you paid more attention to nutrients, limiting nutrients, what kind of wavelengths are important, CO2, which is, you know, again, we keep talking about it, and it's something that's freely available in the air, but is a totally different challenge for something living underwater.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult, especially when you're you've got a lot of surface flow and a lot of bubbling action going on. All that CO2 tends to just dissolve and exit the water and leave it. So, you know, if you get into the higher end tanks, you do have to pay more attention to those things. But it really is learning the balance between like how the nitrogen cycle works, you know, getting those bacteria started and breaking down the ammonia that turn into nitrite, you know, which the plants can use more readily. So it's a lot of understanding basic biology principles, but also at the same time, it's also watching the plants and seeing if they're nutrient deficient. You know, do they have pinholes on their leaves? Are they like shedding leaves at the bottom? So it's kind of there's a lot to watch, but it's also kind of, it's very rewarding just watching plants grow, you know, from one day to the next, you can actually see growth in your plants.
Yeah, and the thing that always excited me most is when I really started to hit my stride in my attempts was actually watching oxygen bubbles exiting the leaves. You're literally watching photosynthesis, you know, the end product of it at least, like a conveyor belt coming out of the leaves and returning to the atmosphere eventually. And that, to me, is the most exciting thing about growing any plants, but especially when you can sit and watch something, like you said, so rapidly take place, it really changes sort of the perspective you have on the timescale of how plants operate.
Yeah, we call that in the aquascaping community, it's called pearling, because they look like little pearls of oxygen. They're pearls of gas basically sitting on the leaves. And if you can achieve that in your tank, you know that your plants are doing well. And most people, whenever they see that the first time, they're always like in awe of it, because it's just something that you wouldn't even think about seeing in an aquarium underwater. So yeah, it's pretty amazing. And the amount of plant varieties out there is just, it's astounding how many plants can actually grow underwater. It's a lot of fun just seeing all that action happening all at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, the variety, even beyond what you would go and see at a normal pet store, when you really start to get into it, I've picked up magazines recently that are more dedicated to the hobby than I have been in recent years, but it's amazing just in the last, you know, decade what's become available and the amount of different plant species that people can experiment with and grow. And that's a really interesting point in and of itself, is just if you really like a variety of plant species, wow, this is a whole new world available to you in what you can do in a relatively small space with a relatively decent sized aquarium. But from a beginner's standpoint, for those listening that haven't gotten into it fully, you know, what were some of the early plants you experimented with, some of the early successes that might be doable on, say, a limited budget versus someone that's a little more technologically into it?
So for someone starting out, I would say you're not going to have a lot of money to put into lights or towards a CO2 system. You can definitely keep a tank without CO2 and low lights. I'd stick with more of the low light plants, which would be things like Anubias or Cryptocoryne. Those are both aeroids. And then there's some grasses that will do pretty well, some ground cover plants. It really depends. And there's a bunch of resources out there on the internet now that distribute plant. There's plant retailers now that exclusively sell aquarium plants. So you can always check out their websites and see if they rate them as like high, medium, or low light, or like high tech, requires CO2, or is a very finicky plant. I'm trying to think of some other easier plants. Rotalas are fairly easy for the most part. Some Echinodora species do fairly well in lower lights too. And some mosses, actually. Mosses are some of the easiest to grow without any light and nutrients. And you wouldn't even imagine that there were aquatic mosses out there, but the variety that exists is almost limitless. And there's a lot more to find out there. There's constantly new plants being discovered that will grow in the aquarium. So,
yeah, and that's a really interesting point to bring up, is just, again, the variety of types of plants that are available. When I first got into it, it was the Elodias, and then, you know, the occasional lilies or Potamogeton. A big chunk of it was aeroids, but now, you know, like you mentioned, you can kind of hit the gamut from the non-vascular liverworts, like you have Rickettsia and Rickettsiocarpus, all the way up to something a lace sword plant from the Amazon. It's just such a bewildering variety of shapes, textures, colors that are now coming into being, you know, relatively easily available for most people.
Yeah, there's actually one really cool plant called, I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's spelled like Suswassertang. And I believe it's the sporophyte form of a fern.
Really?
So it never goes into the gametophyte stage, I believe. It's a really cool plant.
Wow.
Yeah, there's definitely some interesting discoveries, I would say.
And again, the layers of interest here, it's really cool because you could just be purely aesthetic with this. You just love the shape, the textures, and the overall look of a completed aquascape. Or you can be a total plant nerd like we are and just dive really into it and get super excited about that sort of thing. So I guess as the hobby evolved for you, you know, what really started to change about A, your approach, and B, the kinds of species that you were taking stabs at? And then we can kind of go from there into sort of the competitive elements of this.
Yeah, so I originally started out just growing plants. And then once I started getting more equipment like CO2 and higher lighting, I kind of went into this phase of what we call collectoritis. A lot of people go through it. It's just trying to get any available plant out there, especially rare ones, because for some reason people always love rare plants. If it's uncommon or hard to get or hard to grow, people will try to do it. and I went through a big phase of collectoritis. a lot of these plants can be very demanding. They are soft water only, like the Areocolons from Australia and the Tonina species from South America. Those are purely soft water, so you need an RO system. So I got one of those just to grow them. Hmm. And then, you know, after a while, the collectoritis got kind of out of control. There's not enough tanks to hold all the different plants that I wanted to grow. And at some point, I was just like, I can't keep doing this. And one of my friends, I'm in a club called the Chicago Aquatic Plant Society. I'm an executive board member on that. And one of the other board members on there kind of got me to do an aquascaping competition with him 3 years ago. And I had always seen works from this guy in Japan. His name is Takashi Amano.
Yes.
He's kind of, yes, he's very well known if you're in the aquascaping community. He's the godfather of what we call Nature Aquarium. So I saw some works by Takashi Amano. And they were always in the back of my head, like his aquascapes. I just didn't think I was good enough to do it. So at one point, I just decided to enter a competition and try out aquascaping, which is kind of more of the landscaping side of aquascaping. It's more of placing plants in specific locations, you know, hardscape. Everything becomes one whole piece. It all flows together, I guess I would say. Takashi Amano, his tanks are amazing. He started out, I believe it was in the 70s, and he was growing aquarium plants with seltzer water because there was CO2 in the seltzer water, and he would put it in to kind of give a CO2 boost to his plants. And it was back when he was doing these tanks, there was almost nothing available, and he would just go out collecting plants. So it was really interesting. He's got a biography out there it's a good read.
Oh, cool.
He's also a photographer by trade, so he has a lot of photography books. And he started taking pictures of his aquariums, and he has this Nature Aquarium series, which is pretty well known. It's kind of the beginnings of Nature Aquarium style as we know it. So I just tried to do what he does. Not good by any means. It was a really bad aquarium, but I mean, it was just me starting out. So I was like, sure. I'm going to give it a shot. You know, maybe it'll turn out well, maybe it won't. And then, you know, I think I kind of have an eye for this stuff, but it's not perfect. But there's enough people out there where I could get feedback and then start developing my own style. So that's kind of how it started for me with the aquascaping. And then at that point, I was like, I can't deal with this collectoritis anymore. So I kind of dropped that, and now I'm more into the aquascaping side of it.
That's really interesting. And it's kind of cool to see that transition between, you know, that pendulum swing of, oh my God, this is amazing, I have to do all of it, to kind of like, oh, I found my niche, and now I've found what I want to do and what really brings me enjoyment. And one of the things that you keep mentioning is this idea of a nature aquarium. And for me, that was the big push into this world of finding out more about aquascaping. I'm not competitive myself, but it was kind of at the same time I was realizing that, you know, animals and all the things I liked in nature came from somewhere. They had a habitat, and the more you could mimic a more naturalistic habitat, the happier the fish seemed to be, the shrimp, whatever you were trying to keep seemed to be. And that really kind of comes down at the core of the idea of a nature aquarium is in one form or another mimicking wild settings or processes more than, say, you know, the little treasure chest or the scuba diver and the puke colored gravel and all the stuff that, you know, you think of as the cliche aquarium setup, right?
Yeah. Amano's theory, when you look at one of his tanks, you don't think of it as aquarium. What I like to think of is it's almost kind of a representation of nature. More abstract. It could be abstract. It could be very specific. Some people like to copy nature directly or try and mimic it directly. But it's more of a whole piece rather than just growing some plants and having a tank full of plants. There's just something about it that kind of pulls you away from the plants and the fish and the rocks. And it kind of makes it one whole cohesive piece of work. And it wouldn't be complete without any of those pieces in it. So we always have fish, we always have plants, we always have wood or rocks in the tanks, and they just kind of all fit together. And it seems like that's a popular thing to do. Like, it's almost like painting, and that's what I really enjoy about it. It's kind of like the artistic side of it.
Yeah, which is really exciting, because oftentimes you think of sort of the scientific nature aspect of things as being nature, and then there's art, and often, you know, they do combine in amazing ways, but to be able to use nature as art in this way is phenomenal. And to me, there are a few things more relaxing than sitting back in front of a large aquascaped aquarium and just sitting there and watching it, and it's just, you get lost and you go, oh, that was 5 hours of my day and I feel good. Like, I'm not stressed, I'm not freaking out about anything. That to me is amazing. But like you said, it's like a paint, it's like painting for you, and it becomes this artistic element as well of being able to visualize something and bringing all these pieces into making a holistic expression of whatever it is batting around in your head at that point in time. So from the artistic side of it to more of the competitive side of it, like, what is going on at an Aquascape design competition? I mean, how does it play out? What are you given? Do you have to bring your own stuff? How is it judged? Like, what's this whole process like?
Okay, so there's two different types of aquascaping competitions. One is more of a live aquascaping competition where you can bring materials, bring plants, and they supply a tank. Sometimes they also supply the plants and the materials. And then there's also the photo competitions where you tend to have your tank at home and then you set it up. And when your tank is ready, when that final moment comes, you take a picture and submit that. So for the live tanks, the standard procedure is either you have the hardscape material, which is like the wood and the rocks and the sand and all that. You have that supplied, and sometimes the plants too, or you bring your own, and you have to set up the tank at the location. And the all the contestants do it at the same time. They're allowed the same time to do it. And then they're all judged kind of when the time limit comes. So after the time limit's reached, you can't escape anymore. And then the judges come around, they look at everyone's tank and they grade them. And then they basically place you, they rank you. Whereas the photos, they tend to be online. They're much more approachable because you can submit your tank from anywhere in the world. A lot of these are international. The US has one called the Aquatic Gardeners Association contest. They're the ones that run the US one. Japan has one, which is IAPLC, International Aquatic Plant Layout Contest. And then China also has one, Taiwan. So there's a bunch of these popping up now. Hmm. So there's more and more nowadays. There used to only be two. AGA was a big one, and IAPLC was the other one. And there's actually quite a large cash prize. I mean, I think if you win first place for IAPLC, it's around $10,000 US.
Oh, wow. Dang.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's money involved in some of these contests.
Yeah, I could see where the hint of saying kind of doing it professionally can kind of come into play there if you hit a few circuits and do pretty well. That's and as you're describing this, to me, a live aquascaping competition, there needs to be like a Netflix show there somewhere, like a Nailed It version. I'm sick of the cooking shows. Let's do like aquarium design or landscaping stuff like that. That's really exciting.
That would be so much fun if we could do something like that. There's a lot of people now that social media is so accessible, I guess. A lot of people just live stream when they're at these competitions, and everybody in the community kind of knows everyone else. It's not a very large community and everyone's pretty close. So we all know all these other people that scape. And like in the US, there's a relatively small group of people that do this. So I think there's less than 50.
Wow.
But in Asia, it's definitely a much more popular hobby. I would say. Or in Europe.
Yeah, growing plants in general, gardening, I think is more big in Europe and Asia than it is in the US culturally, whatever. But, you know, in thinking about this from either a landscape perspective, an artistic perspective, but just everyone kind of has their own philosophy, whether you're growing plants or painting or landscaping. I'm curious what you bring to the table when you're setting up some sort of design. Is there a certain aesthetic you're aiming for? Are you more like whatever's inspiring me at that moment? Do you have species you always want to include, or are you just kind of more experimental? How do you approach this?
Since I'm fairly new to this, I tend to be slightly more experimental. I definitely work better with stone. Some people do really well with wood. I can't work with wood for the life of me. I need practice. What I'll tend to do is I'll literally just sit in front of an empty tank and just like start moving stones around. Some people tend to get inspiration directly from nature. They'll say, look at, you know, a landmark, maybe something like the Grand Canyon or some national parks like Yellowstone or something. They might look at some photos and try and directly replicate that. Others are much more abstract. They kind of go by feel and they just kind of look at the stones or look at the wood and just... There are certain artistic concepts that come into play when you're doing competitive aquascaping, you know, rule of thirds or things like that. But, you know, I won't get too much into that. And perspective plays a huge role in aquascaping. But I'm more of a go by my like gut feeling. Like, what kind of feeling do I want to replicate in this tank? So how do I put the stones to express that feeling is normally how I do it.
Nice.
But I definitely know other people who do it the other way, who say, I want to make this in my tank. And then, you know, they'll make the Grand Canyon in their tank.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like Bob Ross always says, there's more than one way to do this. This is just the way it works for you, right? But that's what's so cool is, again, it becomes this hobby that is both challenging and relaxing, you know, and anytime you can kind of stimulate your mind, but also sit back and go like, ah, that feels good. That's super healthy for you. And I'm curious, you know, you've obviously been at this for a bit now. You've evolved and you're going to continue to evolve with it. But what kind of plants have always stuck with you, and what things are you kind of having success with now that maybe you weren't before? I mean, are there certain groups that really stand out, or individual species that really just tickle you?
So since I'm very aquascaping focused right now, there are, I would say, a smaller set of plants that I tend to stick with. Mostly the smaller fine leaf species are what I go with just to create better perspective in my tanks. But I do really love aeroids. Cryptocrinae are some of my favorites, same with Anubias. And one of the more recent discoveries, I think, is the Buccophalandra.
Yeah.
Or Buccophalandra, I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce them. They're a relatively new aquatic species to the hobby, and I think discovery in general. There weren't too many species that existed before, but now they're starting to be named. And the problem with those guys is they're from Borneo, and a lot of their habitat is being destroyed, and they're also being overcollected right now at this point. So there's a fine line between wild-collected Buccophalandra and getting like farmed ones. They're a really interesting species though, because their leaves are underwater. There's like blue pigmentation in them. They're purple, red. They have like the rainbow of colors, and they're just stunning under the water. So they're one of my favorites.
Yeah, I keep getting hints of them. You know, they'll come up on blogs or pictures will be posted to Twitter or something like that. And they are gorgeous, but I have yet to actually see one in person. But it is kind of this tragedy where so much of what's being discovered and coming in new across the board, not just aquatic plants, is the fact that we're getting into areas where humans haven't been able to get to, or very few humans have been able to get to before. And sometimes when you're seeing new stuff come in, it's a symptom of this destruction that you mentioned. And there is a fine line between wanting that new thing and having ex situ conservation, whether that's in a botanical garden or among hobbyists, and then over collection. And that is always kind of like, there's such a tension there that really needs to be balanced.
Yeah. And the good thing about it is now that a lot of plant producers in the aquarium industry are starting to lean towards tissue culture propagation methods. I mean, aquatic plants are not necessarily very hard to propagate.
Sure.
They're very weedy for the most part. I mean, there's some slow growing. The aeroids are amongst the slower growing of the aquatic plants, but even then, a lot of them are being tissue cultured in large quantities. So I think preserving all this information and all these species is pretty important. And I'm actually starting to delve into a little bit of tissue culturing myself, which is kind of fun.
What does that entail? Because that's something that does come up in horticulture quite a bit. And a lot of people aim to get tissue cultured or at least seed started. But a lot, you know, for instance, carnivores, tissue culture is a big way of getting ethically sourced plants. So what does that entail?
So a lot of it entails basically getting a little cutting of the plant and starting to produce. What you go through is a multiplication phase where you start to get shoot multiplication when you put it into this sterile media. So tissue culture has to be done in sterile conditions. Aseptic conditions is the most important thing. Otherwise, if you have a contaminated sample, most of the time the contamination will eventually outgrow or kill or outcompete the little starting culture. And then you start with this media that basically contains all the macro and micronutrients that plants require to grow. You'll sometimes add some hormones to get shoot proliferation. And then, you know, once you get enough shoot proliferation, you will change hormones over to something that maybe promotes root growth. And then at that point, once the explants get large enough, you know, you can just take them out of culture and then start growing them outside of culture.
Wow, that's wild. And thank God plants are such a modular organism to allow that kind of process to work.
Yeah, they're quite amazing. I mean, it's amazing what you could just take a little node from one of these aquatic plants, stick it in, you know, some tissue culture, and you can multiply it insanely fast compared to, you know, non-aseptic techniques where you would have to like pot it up and then you need all this other space to grow it out. So tissue culture is one of those areas where we as aquascapers enjoy it because, well, one thing, there's no algae in them because they're sterilized. And another is that they just seem to respond, they grow much faster. I mean, I've had plants that take off, their root systems are amazing, you know, within a week.
Wow. So that's pretty remarkable. And another cool thing that I think about in terms of aquatic plants and versatility on that, and on that kind of thought process, is just this idea that not all of them are necessarily fully aquatic plants. Some of them live on the edges of waterfalls or in mudflats and deal with periodic flooding. But the fact that you can have a plant that does equally as well or does well in air as it does in water just absolutely blows my mind. Because to me, the machinery at the cellular level would have to be so different.
Oh yeah, it's quite amazing that they can go back and forth between submersed and immersed growth. I mean, yeah, a majority of these are riparian species. There's very few, I think, truly aquatic species. I only know of two off the top of my head, and they're both Blyza species. So there's very few true aquatic species out there, and most of them are growing at the river's edge. So I love to go out collecting myself personally. We in the U.S., we have a good amount of aquatic species that can actually grow in the aquarium. It's just finding them and discovering them, which is kind of the fun part.
Yeah, I'll never forget the first time I saw a Ludwigia on a mudflat kind of ambling along. You could see where it was in the water and then had come out and had changed sort of its morphology, but then flowering. That blew my mind. I was like, what? I grew up with you in my aquarium, but never knew what you were capable of.
Oh yeah, it's so much fun. And then especially when you can flower plants yourself or just kind of throw them outside and have them do their own thing for a while and then bring them back in and put them in your aquarium. Some people just keep most of these plants immersed at some form or another because it's easier just to maintain them. Hmm. Sometimes in the aquariums, they grow so fast, they're just uncontrollable. So yeah. It's most of them are weedy, I would say, is
sure.
Is what, yeah.
Which has unfortunately led to, you know, rampant invasions within a handful of different aquatic species, which is why you never release any of your contents of your aquariums back into the wild. Just
yes, do not do that. I hope nothing has happened because of the, like, none of the aquascapers, but you never know. I think some of the plants we do have are from the aquarium industry,
sure,
which is kind of sad.
Right. But I mean, like any hobby, there's gradations. There's people who are really good at it and people who are not so ethical and aren't very good about it. But again, there's no reason you can't, in a contained environment, enjoy these species. And you mentioned flowers, which is, to me, one of the weirdest things, is because, again, I was so used to growing these things for foliage. They are amazingly textured, colored, variety of shapes and styles of leaves. Anything you could possibly imagine is going on under there. But many of them are flowering plants, and they're kind of like whales in that all of their ancestors were terrestrial. So, yes, you'll get flowers occasionally, but that, in this case, are there any plants that you know of in the aquarium hobby that actively flower underwater, or does most of it revolve around some sort of hydrological cycle where part of them would come out of the water at some point?
A lot of what we call the stem plants, like Ludwigia or Rotala, they tend to flower out of water, emergent. But there are some that actually do flower underwater. A lot of the aeroids actually will put up a spathe underwater and flower. So I've seen Anubias flowering underwater, and Bucephalandra for sure will flower underwater. Cryptocrines tend not to as much. I've not seen that as often. But a lot of the aeroid species tend to be more open to flowering underwater. I think they're just happy underwater. They just start putting out a flower spike, but who knows? I don't know the exact mechanism by which they do it.
Sure. And I mean, I'm sure if they're living in some sort of dynamic, seasonally flooded environment, the predictive ability of when that water level is going to drop, I mean, why not? We'll just make a shot at it and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. And some of the mosses actually sporulate underwater sometimes. So you'll see a spore packet coming out once in a while.
Oh, that's
pretty interesting.
That's cool. Huh. So another thing that is really stands out to me that you keep mentioning here is the fact that a lot of these plants really are weedy. You know, they're living in environments where the water can be a disruptive force. They have to be able to grow fast and grow well. If you are in the hobby and very serious about it, such as yourself, do you have aquariums as production centers to kind of keep these plants going? Or do you have setups outside where you put them outside and then when you want pieces of them to put into a scape or to use in a competition, then you go and gather what you need and bring it in? I mean, what is the care like for someone such as yourself that really does enjoy aquascaping and the process of it?
So I'm more on the extreme end. I have what we call multiple tank syndrome. So I have I think I have right now. I have at the moment 1, 2, 3, 4, 7 tanks.
Nice.
Yeah. So I always have one tank as kind of a grow out tank. And I also keep a lot of plants emergent, just kind of in tubs, you know, filled with some soil, and just keep them very moist and covered up. And they do fairly well that way too. But I will order plants whenever I start up a new tank for competition. I'll tend to just order a lot of tissue culture plants, just because those kind of, they go a little longer, they get spread out a little more, and they grow a little more quickly sometimes, and they're cleaner. There's less algae on them, so I don't run into as many algae issues in the tank, because that's kind of the bane of any planted aquarium, is lots of algae.
Yeah.
So you're going to encounter it at one point or another. There's so many forms of it that you'll see all different types. It's just inevitable. You know, it's kind of in the air, and those spores will eventually land in your water and just take over everything.
Yeah, it's amazing how suddenly something just appears. You know, there was no reason for it to be in your house, but it's there. And the one thing I always got a kick out of in reading about these, you know, Q&As with plant growers and experts like that, was people would write in about a certain type of algae, and they would say, well, the good news is this algae really likes good conditions, so you must be doing something right. The bad news is to kill it, you probably have to keep it subpar for your plants.
Oh yeah, that's for sure. There's some algae that are almost impossible to eradicate. There's even some plant species that we consider weedy, which is like Rickettsia and Utricularia species. There's also some interesting Utricularia species, which I forgot to mention. So those are pretty cool.
Yeah, I don't see that. At least, again, I'm very limited into the aquascaping world, but it is really neat to think of, you know, the Utricularias, for all intents and purposes, are very often fully aquatic, and their floating form can handle some drying in their dormant phase. Are they popular, or are they just often too weedy for most people to consider in you know, adding a carnivorous plant to your setup?
Most of them are too weedy. There is one Utricularia species. I don't know if that's the correct way to pronounce it, but
yeah, sure.
There's one species that is very, very popular among the hobbyists. It looks like a grass almost, so, and it tends to grow as a ground cover, which is a very nice, it's very low growing, and it kind of carpets the whole aquarium. So that's the only, it's Utricularia graminifolia.
Yeah, grass-like leaves.
Yep, that's the only one that I know of that people want. There's another one that's extremely weedy called Utricularia gibba, which is very hard to get rid of.
Well, it was one of those weird things where my nerdy mind would be like, I need a jar just for that.
Some people might want it. I don't know. They could be feeding koi or something, you know? It's plants have many, many uses.
Indeed. Yeah, that's the other good point, is that there's so many reasons to get into this hobby, and there really is something for you, whatever that reason is. And that's also a very exciting thing for people. You know, it's a weird times. We're all stressed in our own way. And again, if you have something to come home to blow off steam and just kind of get absorbed in it, this is a great hobby for that.
Yeah, I find it just extremely relaxing to come home and then just kind of plop down in front of my tanks. And even the maintenance is, you know, it's kind of zen and meditative. You just go in and you take your scissors and you start pruning plants and, you know, shaping them. It's a very relaxing way to, like, end the day, I would say.
Sure. And I'm guessing, you know, if you're good at culturing or propagating, that just opens up the amount you can trade and interact with other hobbyists and get to know people and find new things.
Yeah, it's definitely starting to grow in the U.S. We have a lot of local clubs. So Chicago has one. Dallas has one. There's also one in Washington, D.C. area, Minnesota. So these clubs are starting to pop up all over the U.S. And it's kind of just a fun place for us to come and meet and trade plants and talk about our tanks and how to fix certain algae issues, or, you know, just chat away about these aquariums, which is, yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Right on. So as a grower and someone that really enjoys this, Are there like holy grail species? Are there plants that you desperately want to try and haven't been able to get your hands on, or just they're too difficult at this point, or picky? You know, is there a few or maybe one species that really stands out to you as kind of being like the, I'll get you someday?
Ooh, I would say that the Cryptocorynes seem to have a strong hold on a lot of people, and there are some very rare crypt species out there. I'm not a crypt specialist, though, so I always hear my club members, like my friends in the club, talking about certain crypt species, and I don't know what they're saying at all. So crypts are one of the more popular species of plants, And I would say some of the Amazon swords can get really popular too, especially some of the slow growing small species. They're really interesting. And the soft water species. Anything that's difficult seems to attract, you know, people just want to do difficult things, it seems. They want a challenge, you know, so
sure.
They'll always gravitate towards those harder to grow species.
That makes sense.
But I also do that. I'm guilty as charged because I bought an RO system just so I could grow certain plants. So that's quite a big investment for a couple of plants.
But, you know, anyone that's a hobbyist that's listening can empathize on some level. We all have our thing. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's you're buying lights, CO2 injectors, RO units, greenhouses, special heating, you know, we can all spend a lot of money on our hobbies if we want to.
Yeah. But I would also say, anything new to the hobby, there's always new plants showing up, and because they're new, they get a lot of attention. So anything that new that shows up, a new variety, a new cultivar, you know, there's a couple cultivars of a lot of plants out there now. So there's like white leaf species, which are totally interesting to me because they have almost no chlorophyll. You know, they're still surviving. They grow a little slower, but you know, they can survive. Those are really popular amongst some people. It's interesting what comes out of the hobby, because a lot of these plants aren't always natural variants either. Some of them are actually created, I believe, or wow. they're mutations that pop up and somebody's like, oh, this is super interesting. So
yeah. I mean, it's horticulture, but just a very specific form of it. So it's inevitable that once that market starts, it's going to roll.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. What about floating aquatics? Is that something that makes its way into the aquascaping hobby very much, or are they generally kind of like, you're just going to steal light from the stuff that's going on down below?
I would say in aquascaping, they're not so popular, but in planted aquariums, people definitely do keep floating plants. There's a lot of Salvinia species. There's a couple of like frog bit. I don't even know the scientific name for frog bit.
You know what? I don't either, now that I think about it.
But there's frog. There's a good number of species, floating species. There's even some Ludwigias that are floating. I think Celadonoides, something like that. So some people do keep some of the floating plants. You know, if they have like a lower tech, lower energy tank, you know, those floating plants help kind of cut down on the light, preventing algae issues to the bottom.
Yeah.
I actually used to do that myself so I didn't have to deal with algae as much. I would just throw in a bunch of floating plants. So.
Smart.
Because they just pull the CO2 from the atmosphere, and then there's no issue with them.
So it's less of the competition aspects. Yeah. And clever. And again, things that you would really think about in your day-to-day life, again, of course, unless you study aquatic plants, but just being a hobbyist opens up these doors to understanding species in such intimate ways. But not even just by themselves, and in terms of interactions, and going back to kind of what we talked about earlier, the amount you can learn from a hobby, even just beyond the joy you get from it, is just remarkable. It's such a cool thing.
Oh yeah, it's just so gratifying to see this tank change. And whenever you show people like beginning to end what the progression of your tank is, they're always astounded. They're always surprised that the tank can undergo such a transformation. So I find that extremely rewarding. I always go back and look at the beginning of my tank. You know, I take pictures, and then I look, you know, at the end, I'm like, whoa, you know, this has really changed. And, you know, that's one of the most enjoyable parts of this hobby.
Yeah, for sure. And one thing that I struggled with early on was seeing some of these pictures of perfect setups and in the moment, these snapshots in time, and being like, why can't my tank always look like that? But now that I'm more of a grower, I do appreciate that evolution, because it is the dynamic nature of plants to kind of grow, find out where they want to be, maybe move around through rhizomes or stolons or bits and pieces of them. And just like you said, watching that process evolve, to me now the dynamic nature of a planted aquarium or jar or just any sort of plant is far more satisfying in the long run than just that one quick snapshot in time, which is equally as cool, but you have to like wrap your head around the fact that that's not possible 100% of the time.
Oh yeah, it definitely takes a lot of practice and intuition and learning the plants. So, you know, you can't just start making those types of aquariums from day one. It just takes years and years of growing these plants and learning how they grow, how fast they grow, how big they'll get, and all of that. It just takes time to learn all of that stuff. And I think a lot of people go through the same process that I did. They start growing plants, you know, and then they start seeing their plants do really well. Then they start, you know, growing different species. And at some point, you know, they've done all the species that are available out there. And then they kind of maybe move on to aquascaping. I don't know. I don't know if this is the final step, but it's enjoyable, I will say.
And that's the important part. No matter what it is, there's no maybe end goal. It's just how much are you getting through and enjoying it. But, you know, for, if we've kind of lit the fire under anyone listening that really wants to kind of dive in and give it a shot, you know, again, maybe on a limited budget or if not, I mean, what are some considerations to think about in going into setting up a tank and getting, you know, healthy plants before you even get to kind of the extreme end of aquascaping and hardscapes and all that stuff?
So I would recommend if you're maybe close to a local club, you know, look for a local club that's available nearby. They're probably going to be the most helpful because there's just so much information there. Otherwise, you know, you could scour the internet. There's a couple good plant forums, and there's a couple of Facebook groups that are actually pretty popular for planted aquariums. And those are extremely good resources to start off with. You can go to the local pet store and also ask them some questions. I will say some pet stores might be better than others. Sure. We don't tend to have dedicated plant aquarium stores in the US as much, but the internet is a very good source, and so are the local clubs, because they're going to have all the people that know the most information about planted aquariums.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of a better way to get a head start in something than to meet club members. I mean, that's my favorite way to learn about plants and kind of get my head wrapped around the nuances of growing them and what's possible is going to meetings, going to events whenever they're putting on a show or something like that. You just meet the most impassioned people. And the best part is it's not the same person 100% of the time. You're meeting people from all over the world with different interests, different careers that have all found this hobby to their liking, and they bring something different to the table each time.
Oh yeah. And that's the evolution of what's happening right now is these clubs are starting to pop up. You know, people who keep fish are also getting into plants. So I think it's starting to grow a lot more in the US, which is really good. Worldwide, it's already pretty great. So I would say if you want to do it, you know, find a local club. That's the best way to do it, because you're supporting, you're meeting people and also learning at the same time. So it's much more enjoyable than being on the internet sometimes.
Yeah, that's true. And face-to-face interaction.
Face-to-face is best, but I learned most of my stuff through the internet.
Sure.
Because when I was starting up, that's all that was really available. There was no local club in my area. So
yeah, that's great. I mean, you just got to know where to look. But again, meeting local people, if you can, if that's available to you, is a great head start and learning, you know, what even to look up. But, you know, if people want to find out more about your scapes and see them, is there a way to do that online? Do you have a social media presence? It's okay if you don't, too.
Yeah, I have an Instagram, actually. It's msuisan, M-S-U-I-S-A-N.
Awesome. I will put up links to that. I'm going to follow you as well just to see what all cool aquascaping and plants you're looking at. But this has been really fascinating. Thank you so much for introducing us to the world of aquascaping. I'm really excited we were finally able to sit down and have this conversation.
Yeah, thank you for having me. You know, it's been awesome. I love spreading the word.
Yeah, direct people your way. And if people have plant questions, you know, this is good. And keep it up, man. From what you showed me when we first met, it's incredible. And I think you found a really amazing hobby to be involved with. So thanks for introducing us to it.
Yeah, and if anyone has any questions, feel free to like DM me on Instagram. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for talking to us. Have a great evening.
Okay, you too.
All right, cheers. All right, that wraps it up for this week. I thank Marvin for sitting down and talking to us about the wild world of aquascaping. I am definitely going to check out one of those competitive aquascaping challenges, because if you head online and look at any of the aquascapes that people make, you can see it is a world of beauty and artistic expression using plants. Now, keep in mind, aquatic plants have a high propensity for invasive status in a lot of areas around the world. Never, ever, ever take any of your aquatic plants and put them outside where they can escape into the wild. It's created a lot of issues. This is a hobby we can all enjoy to some extent or another, but it's definitely not a good thing when our hobbies interfere severely with the environment. But I encourage every one of you to give aquascaping a shot, if you don't mind having an aquarium in your house. The world of aquatic plants is extremely varied, and we could have probably had an entire podcast dedicated to this. But in the meantime, check out Marvin's Instagram page and see some of the cool designs and plants that he's worked with. Also, don't forget, we have apparel for sale. Head on over to teespring.com/stores/indefensiveplants and check out all of the cool designs. And don't forget, a portion of your purchase will be donated to the Rainforest Trust. As always, there is tons of great stuff on the horizon, so keep checking back in, and the best way to do that is to hit that subscribe button. So, until next week, this is your host, Matt, signing out. Adios, everyone.